Why so serious?
All the toys, all the time.
I am the game and still getting trying to play dude.
You know the rules. This isn't a toy.
But we bought it at the toy store.
We did, but the way I'm using it makes it an adult thing.
Are you ready to play the game?
Yeah! Welcome to the Toy Department with Matt Kolsky and Derek Madden.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, Toy Department time, everybody. I'm Derek Madden. He's Matt Kolsky. We're doing this at a weird time, for at least for me. I'm a little out of sorts. I don't know about you.
Oh, there was one thing I meant to mention in the pre-production meeting that I was got some stuff to do today still, so I wasn't going to post this till the regular time.
Okay, so you'll get this at the regular time. It's still going to be a weird time for us.
Yeah.
Which probably means the show will be a weird time for you guys. That's usually how it works.
Oh, like a weird time out.
Yeah, yeah.
Or in, or wherever you are.
Exactly. All right. We don't have a ton to cover this week. One of the homework items was not available to me, so we're going to push the Fighting With Family till next week. We are going to talk about some of the stuff that's streaming right now, and it's interesting to me, actually. I had this conversation with a friend of mine who claimed that they don't enjoy Netflix original programming and that Hulu original programming is much better.
Okay.
What do you mean? What does that mean? It means exactly what it said it means.
But that's such a goofily broad thing to say. It's not like Netflix programming is all designed by the same group.
Yeah. They don't like Netflix shows. They like Hulu shows. It made no sense to me, and really, the idea that Hulu original programming would be better than Netflix original programming seems like demonstrably false.
Well, but even if it is, that's like just I don't understand. I still don't understand what that comment means, but we can move past it.
Well, I mean, look, if I said to you HBO programming is better than FX programming, like you could agree or disagree with that statement, but you wouldn't be like, well, what do you mean, right?
I guess it depends on the tone. The way you put it, a friend of yours doesn't like Netflix programming and thinks Hulu programming is better. To me, and even in those cases, like John Landgraf is in charge of FX programming in a way that I don't think anyone's in charge of Netflix programming. They do a lot of giving out money and letting people do their thing. Like, what does GLOW have to do with Black Earth Rising?
Look, I agree with you that you know, the body of Netflix program is incredibly diverse and hard to describe.
I guess that's my issue. Like, but FX programming or HBO programming, I feel like you say that, you still kind of mean a thing. Like, what Netflix programming is damn near everything.
I mean, but it's not really when you're talking about their original shows, right? Like, yes, Netflix has a flood the zone strategy, so there are many, many, many more shows than, say, FX or HBO, which really does one night of original programming. You know, there's so many more, but it's not like, I guess you couldn't say that they don't have a unifying strategy. I think what she meant by saying it was, I like some shows on Hulu. I don't really like any of the shows on Netflix. I don't know that she was necessarily trying to speak for the writ large platform by itself. Either way, it struck me as a really odd thing to say because there's so many great shows on Netflix. You know what I mean? Like, I think we spend a lot of time on this podcast talking about Netflix shows and very little about Hulu shows. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, but also there's just so many different kinds of Netflix shows. Whereas, like, I only know of a few Hulu shows, and maybe that's my own ignorance.
Right, and I felt like that too. Like, maybe I'm not enough of a Hulu file to really like run down.
We pay for Hulu. I have Hulu.
Yeah, me too. But I barely watch it. To be honest, it's definitely like third in the pecking order for me, and that's primarily because I'm not using Hulu to watch reruns. I don't pay for like the live television Hulu.
I was going to say we use it more for reruns.
Yeah.
But what's it called is Hulu, right? The Handmaiden.
The Handmaid's Tale, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, but I mean, were you watching prior to, I should say, and maybe this is a good point to start talking about Pen 15, which I guess is the correct way to say that, right? It's clearly a play on penis.
How many have you seen?
How many have I seen? I would say, I don't know the exact number of that, but it's in the neighborhood of five.
Yeah, well, I've seen, I think, three, and like Pen 15 hasn't come up, so I don't know what.
No, it definitely has not where I'm at either. They have not referenced anything about it, to be honest. So, regardless, this is a show I think that people are. To me, there's as much buzz on this as any Hulu original since Handmaid's Tale, I would say. Do you feel the same?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's true. And interesting, because Handmaid's Tale had so much cachet beforehand and also, like, all these superstars involved and big money behind it. And this seems very, at the risk of being dismissive, tossed off.
Yeah, I mean, look, the Lonely Island guys executive produced this show, and it feels of that sensibility is what I would say.
Uh-huh.
Maybe that worldview. I really enjoy the show. I think this is another one of those cases where I probably have heard too many people talk about it.
I thought it was all right.
Say things like it's the greatest show I've seen in a long time.
That probably didn't help.
Yeah. So I think I was expecting complete and total genius, and it's interesting and pretty good is kind of where I'm at. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, I'm not sure I'd even go that far. I don't, maybe I'm just not the guy for this show. I don't totally get the conceit. It is sometimes funny and sometimes dramatic and pretty real, other than the gag with adults playing a couple of the characters, which is weird. And again, I'm not totally sure to what end other than that.
It's weird, and it gets less weird, you know. So it's a show about, I don't know, what are they?
Yeah.
Sixth graders?
Right. It's less even that it's so weird that sixth or seventh graders – I don't think it's that weird that those people are playing it. It's that it's like the fact that it's old people playing those roles is like a thing, but it's also not a thing. And it's not funny exactly. They don't like acknowledge it or make jokes about it. But I just don't know why you did that other than, again, to just, it's easier to have grown up say some of the foul stuff that's happening.
I guess they're also oddly convincing seventh graders.
Like they're convincing enough that you kind of forget, but then you can't forget. And it's kind of like this off-putting thing that hangs over the show to me. I don't totally understand the point of it. And also just in general, I don't totally understand what this show is. Like, again, it is funny and it does seem pretty authentic in its own way. But, like, it's not exactly a real show about the hard life of seventh graders. And it's not exactly a comedy. Like, I don't totally know what it is.
I think they're trying to do, I mean, I don't know exactly what you mean by real show of the about the heart of seventh graders. But I do think that they are, I think they're trying to pull the Big Mouth balance of, like, seventh grade is gross and funny and horny and weird. And yet also super vulnerable and tender, and you know what I mean? And
well, maybe that's why it falls flat, is because next to Big Mouth, it's flat.
Yeah, which kind of runs me back to the Hulu versus Netflix thing.
Yes.
Because I think this is just, it's interesting, but it's not as good as Big Mouth, and it doesn't quite nail those things as sweetly as those do. But I will say,
it's neither as funny nor as emotionally resonant as Big Mouth, I would say. Not close to as funny. And I just don't think it really hits the emotional tone the same way.
Yeah. But it is funny at times. There are definitely times that I laugh.
But it's the difference between funny at times and, like, one of the funniest things. I mean, that right. Valentine's special is one of the funniest, like, hour whatevers I've had all in a year.
Yeah. I just, yeah, it's, you know what I mean? You're right. It's, I think if we're in the business of just comparing shows to Big Mouth.
Sure. A lot of things fall flat.
Most shows are going to lose. But as I was saying, it's 94% fresh on Rotten Tomatoes and an 82 on Metacritic, which is very high for Metacritic.
Those don't feel wrong to me, and they feel like acknowledgments of something happening here. But at the same time, I wonder how many of those good reviews are like truly excited.
Yeah, I don't know. I'd have to roll through Metacritic and do that, which I'm not going to do in a real time podcast.
No, but I just don't. I find it hard to believe that show was like thrilling or exciting to anyone.
Yeah, no, I do think a lot of people like it. I've also heard that it continues to pick up. So, and I now that I'm looking at episode list, I am five through. So I don't know. Maybe the second half will be better.
Circle back and say, look at the genius of Pen 15.
I'm definitely going to continue watching this one. So,
yeah, I will if you push me, I will.
I'm not going to make you. I'll do that on my own. I'm good. But if you want to, I'm curious, so you saw three episodes, which of the ones was your favorite?
Oh man, I don't know. That's part of the problem. Like they all felt very samey to me. It's like there's these two girls and they're doing seventh grader things. And like, it's kind of funny because they're not seventh graders, but also they're just being seventh graders. I don't know. Probably the second one, I guess.
Okay. I was going to say the OG John with the floating grandpa.
Oh, I was talking about where the brother tells her to tell the call the kid a midget piece of shit.
Yeah. You could sort of see where that one was going.
But I don't know. I don't know that I can't see where any of it is going unless I'm wrong. So we'll find out.
Yes. We will find out down the road. So I'm in for more Pen 15.
I'm not in for more. I'm just not jumping. I'm not like begging for more.
Fair enough. I got to say that I don't know for sure if I'm going to finish either of the next two Netflix offerings we're going
to
discuss.
Yeah, you know, I figure I'm interested to talk about Black Earth Rising, so let's save that. I figured you probably would not be in on Umbrella Academy, but I have to say it's really kind of there is some of that weird fantasy element that generally turns you off, but I do think it's pretty different. I don't know. It's an interesting story.
I agree. It is interesting. The show is not without merit, and I do feel like you can really see Gerard Way's fingerprints on
it. Yeah, exactly. Like weird guy. It's weird guy stuff.
Yeah. Like certain characters sort of feel like they really represent him in a way. Or things that would come from his head.
I probably know more Gerard Way than I do.
Gerard
Way
is the lead singer
of My Chemical Romance.
For those who don't know. And, you know, they were kind of a gothy emo band. And I would say this is kind of a gothy emo show.
Exactly.
And it has a very good musical sensibility. Like, there's really kind of a pretty cool, like, music is pretty prominent. And I would say you're looking at least one solid montage
for
episodes.
It's like late 90s.
Yeah.
It's like late 90s, early 2000s stuff pretty much, right?
Yeah, it's interesting, right, in a show that is ostensibly about time travel, it's kind of like hard to date the show a little bit.
Yeah, there's some things that seem futury, some other things that seem pasty. It's interesting.
You ever know someone really seems to have a cell phone?
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. It's weird.
And the music is all from that era right before cell phones really blew up. So I wonder if that's when it's supposed to take place. But then they like go places and I'm like, that seems weird.
Yeah, I don't know. But like the fashion isn't particularly, say, 90s in any way. Although I guess the members of the Umbrella Academy wear a uniform. So that probably cuts down on some
of
that.
Well, I'm not sure the fashion says a lot.
And it has that sort of like Fincher 7, like perpetually rainy sort of vibe. You know, like visually, I like the show. It's just when
shot
I
shot interestingly.
Yeah, I just it's when I when you start getting into the time travel elements of it and the superpowers and the daddy issues that you know riddle all these characters, then I'm just less interested. Just less interested, you know.
That's fair. I have to say. It's interesting because I thought this had a chance to get to you a little bit more than the average sort of fantasy type thing. It's not necessarily my favorite, but I am kind of locked in from a like fascinated to know what happens standpoint.
Yeah. It's relatively bingeable.
Yeah.
You know,
for it's because it's pretty long. I mean, they're hour long episodes, but I think they flow pretty good and quickly.
Yeah. You know, and interesting people show up, you know.
Yep. Yeah.
You know, like having Mary J. Blige is, you know, sort of an interesting wrinkle, and Ellen Page.
Yeah, exactly. Well, there are, this is a, I don't know if I'd call it star studded, but it's like people you like pop up.
Yeah, I would say that's fair. So it's one of those things where, I don't know, and I couldn't tell if maybe it was just my general superhero malaise.
I think it is. Because I don't know about you, but this was not at all what I expected. I was expecting something more kidsy.
Oh, I was not. I definitely was expecting dark and lots of pathos.
Yeah, but like Lemony Snicket dark was what I was expecting.
Oh, okay. Yeah, no, I... The tone-wise, I got about what I thought I was going to get. I thought I was going to get something gothy with an edge. And, you know, I was curious as to how good the special effects would be. But I think, actually, the Netflix budget really helps this show. You know
what
I mean?
Man, it looks great. Just in every way. I think that all the, you know, the time travel graphic and stuff is good. But I just mean, like, they got some weird stuff going on. And I think it all looks really well. And it's shot really interestingly. Like, some of the crazy fighting stuff they do is shot well. I like it.
Yeah. All right.
I'm talking myself into it even more as we have this conversation. Because I really think, like, it really does. It's a home run in all those ways. It looks great. It holds together, you know? Like, we've seen some things on Netflix that look great and don't. What was the future body jump?
It's like the, were you talking about the, it's like the thing with like Joel Edgerton,
Altered
right?
Carbon.
Yes, that's exactly it.
Like, that looked great and it didn't really hold together. This looks great and it holds together, and it's also just kind of an interesting story. And yeah, there's some daddy issue stuff, and yes, there are powers, but like, I don't know, that stories have things like daddy issues in them. That really is not, you know, maybe it turns you off, but that to me is not, does not, it's not a demerit. And
it's not that I can't watch a show that about people who have daddy issues. I think I probably watch a lot of shows about that.
Yeah.
It's just more that I didn't think any of that was presented. It's all presented in a very ham-handedly, you know what I mean? Like, it's all of these characters have really naked daddy issues that are super prominent in the show. You know what I mean?
Fundamentally, though, the problem for you is that they were all born of these absurd pregnancies with magic powers. That's really, I think, where you jump off.
I understood there's going to be some magic powers coming in. You know what I mean? Like, it's a comic book. It's like magic powers and the time travel and the, you know what I mean? Like, yeah, it just gets too superhero for me.
I don't agree, but I do know what you mean.
Yeah. You know, and again, that's my thing.
This is your corner.
Yeah. If you're not on this corner, I understand. Like it really is, you know, it's almost more of an island than a corner, to be honest. So.
And so, Isthmus, perhaps.
So yeah, so if you want to get a villa on my island, cool, and if not, like, you know, go to your thing. That's fine.
We've got the rest of the world, the rest of us.
Yeah, exactly. The whole rest of the world to play with. Mm-hmm. So you think you probably finished the show up, huh?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
I think I'll finish it up in the next day or two.
Wow. Yeah. See, I could see, yeah, I don't know. It's hard for me to see getting through all of these. I'll let you know
if you're missing anything.
Starting to wear out. So let me know if it turns out to be any good. And then likewise, in a completely different way, I sort of feel the same about Black Earth Rising.
Well, now you're on my corner.
Okay. Is that
because this is Bad Time Entertainment?
Gotcha. I couldn't tell if that's where you were going with that or not. Because
it's
certainly
like a
see
slap
qualifies.
In the face and a kick to the nuts and a punch in the gut every time you watch it.
How would you
I couldn't.
Sorry, go ahead. I was going to say, how would you describe the plot of this show to our listeners who haven't seen it or heard anything about it or didn't do the homework?
I would describe it as like a really artful and serious handling of one of the worst ongoing and horrifying news stories in the world. Is that fair?
Yeah, no, I think that's a fair summary of the show. I don't really know if it's a summary of the plot.
Oh, the plot. I guess I would say adult woman who was a child, an adopted child out of war-torn African nation, is forced to be an intimate part of the bloody prosecution of alleged war criminals involved in her youth.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I guess that comes about right. I feel like this show, I think artful is a really good word. Hugo Blick, which is why I kind of wanted to watch the show, has done some really interesting work in this kind of geopolitical thriller area.
This is a perfect example of a show that I literally have nothing bad to say about, except that I don't really want to watch it.
Yeah, I got done. I was like, maybe it's me. Maybe, you know, like maybe I'm just not smart enough to stay with this.
No, I mean, Michaela Cole and John Goodman are brilliant. This is important stuff. And it's just like someone driving a corkscrew into my eye.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know that you could make a better show about this. And I just don't know that I can get through it.
Yeah, I think that's a really great way to put it. It's like it's not that I would even have notes. You know what I mean? You did great.
We have had a number of cases throughout this podcast where like I've dreaded watching something over the course of a week and put it off and watched it and finally been like, man, that was great. And it's not that I didn't feel like this was great. But I felt like my trepidation had been very well justified.
I didn't remember you expressing trepidation on the way into this.
Yeah, I mean, it's not that I had trepidation over the concept of watching it. It's that when it came down to sitting down and spending time in this world, I was like, oh, that sounds hard. I don't want to do that.
Yeah, it does. It feels like homework.
Yeah. And not in the math homework way. It's like hard work watching it. It's painful.
Yeah. And really like right from the opening scene, you know, where
this
criminal lawyer is like, you know, defending her involvement, you know, in the international court, which I'm sure seemed reasonable to her. And then these activists are kind of questioning her and it all seems reasonable to them. And it just seems like this really hard, impossible situation. And just like you're just generally stressed. You know what I mean? Like these people give their lives to this cause, you know, trying to make peace while the world ignores them. And it seems like really hard, thankless work. And meanwhile, there are all these horrible atrocities that leave these often literal scars on people, but certainly emotional scars. And
yeah,
yeah, you're right. It's bad. It is bad time TV.
And maybe this is the point, but I still have to make decisions about how I'm going to spend my time in front of the television, and I just don't know that I can spend another 4 hours or 5 hours or whatever it would be being sad.
Yeah. I'm going to ask this question, and maybe I'm getting out ahead of really what we're, you know, next week's show, but you know, what's the difference in committing 4 more hours to this and committing 4 more hours to True Detective? Like, isn't True Detective essentially also bad time TV?
See, I kind of... Excuse me. I kind of dig the mystery there a little more. Like, there is a mystery fundamentally at the heart of Black Earth Rising, and I suppose we'll see if we find out or not.
Yeah, I think they're going to get a lot further into the mystery than...
But I think also part of the bad time here is how real it is. Like, I legit looked up to see if this was based on someone's true story. Because it all feels like it all could have happened.
Yeah.
And True Detective is just, like, even if it's realistic in a lot of ways, it's still just like this... multiple timeline mystery, creepy mystery story about, you know, murder most foul. It just feels more dramatic and theatrical, and I can enjoy the mystery without being beset by the emotion of the reality.
It's certainly more theatrical, but I would say it's just as dark, right? And it's also about people who are emotionally broken and scarred. You know what I mean?
But it's less real, right? I mean, it's just that to me there is there's
Scoot
something.
McNary. Sorry.
I love Scoot.
He's living it, man. Living it.
Don't make me speak against Scoot.
I'm not going to speak against Scoot. Do you think afterwards, when True Detective was over, like Scoot just there was some point where he just burped up all the scenery that he chewed? Was there like a big scenery aftertaste?
I'm liking True Detective a lot more than you. We'll talk about that next week.
Yeah, we will. I can't wait to rip True Detective. fired up about it now, just thinking about it. All right, let's move on to something that is the opposite of bad time television. It's time to check in on our beloved Top Chef.
Top Chef, we really need like a good sounder for when we check in on our beloved Top Chef.
So
like some knife sounds or something. Yeah. Ching.
Top Chef continuing to get mileage out of Kentucky, even after I think that it can't possibly.
How did we miss this, though? How did we miss the KFC challenge?
Yeah, it is true.
Like, we literally sat here on this podcast going, well, I don't know what else they can do with Kentucky. How about Kentucky Fried Chicken? Dumbasses.
Yeah. And they nailed that. And then we also, I mean, honestly, we whiffed on Muhammad Ali too, which is another thing that if you've been in Louisville for 5 minutes.
That was a stretch. You know what I mean? Like the Kentucky Fried Chicken, which should have been the first thing. Before we both came up with hot browns, we should have imagined that they would do a Kentucky Fried Chicken challenge.
Yes, you're right. It definitely should have been in like the first three things that we would think they would do about Kentucky. And that, I don't know about you, but that definitely made me want to go eat some fried chicken.
Oh my God. And there's not a lot of great fried chicken in the Bay Area. Like Churches and Popeyes are okay, but I don't know. I got to find Brown Sugar Kitchen, former Top Chef, Tanya, is it?
Yeah. I would think you could get a good one there. I will give you.
You can't get good fried chicken there. They do a fried chicken and waffles. That's good.
The place I would recommend if you are in San Francisco, is Farmer Brown. And they have a side restaurant or a second restaurant called Little Skillet. I think may have a couple of locations around.
All right.
Top notch fried chicken. That would be my
Farmer Brown. It is. Yeah. But yeah, they looked like they did a heck of a job. That was really one of the themes of this week was everyone is really good and good chefs are going down now.
We definitely seem to be at that point in the competition, right? Where you're gonna you're gonna go home because your dish got nitpicked a little bit. You know what I mean?
Exactly. And I thought, in particular, with the fried chicken, like it seemed like everyone who tried to put it in a fryer, the fryers were all too hot, so it cooked weird. Did you notice that?
Yeah. You know what? Not until you said it, but. But
there's
stuff
like that on Top Chef where I'm like, well, that's a bummer. It seems like someone screwed them on the fryers, or like when someone's oven breaks down or something, you know, or the power goes out.
Yeah.
And I'm like, man, they're about to get eliminated. That's rough. And they never seem to give those people any sort of a break. But
no, but the fact that it was a quick fire helps a little bit in that situation,
yes.
Since you know you're not gonna go home over it.
And I gotta say, like, the two winners this week are the favorites at this point, right? Sarah and Eric feel like they've elevated to a level that the other people aren't quite at right now.
I still think this is kind of anybody's to win.
Yeah, it is.
And I might rank Eric and Sarah 1-2, but I think there is a gap between Eric and Sarah.
Eric is killing it, man.
Yeah.
Like Eric is, and I gotta say, this was I don't know if it's just an emotional week or it was that I had also recently watched Black Earth Rising and I was still reeling from that, but I found this to be a very emotional episode of Top Chef for something that didn't have a lot of specifically emotional moments.
Oh, interesting. How so?
I don't know. Like, the way everybody identified with the Muhammad Ali stuff got to me somehow, and like, Eric talking about being able to cook African food, and when Tom was like, hey, I bet you've been told you're not allowed to cook this sort of stuff a lot in your life, and he was like, yeah, and he was tearing up, I was tearing up a little bit, we had a moment.
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't know
that
what
might
was.
Have been you.
Maybe I'm just emotional today.
I mean, it seemed to me like it's mostly like the dudes wanted to get with Layla. That was what I noticed.
I can't blame anybody, but I probably shouldn't bring that up.
Okay.
Well, I just went. I happened to go on the Top Chef website, and there happened to be a link to Padma's National Pizza Day photo shoot.
Oh, have you? Is that your first exposure to the National Pizza Day photo shoot?
Yeah,
because it's legendary.
Oh, so that's not new.
It's not new, no. I think she broke it out because it was National Pizza Day.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay.
But it's...
it was new to me, man.
It's quite something if you haven't seen it before.
Man, she's something else.
There's also a nice video of her on her Instagram with Layla. Layla giving her some boxing lessons. It's kind of enjoyable as well.
Cool.
Yeah. I'm here for you and all your Padma content needs.
Yeah, I mean, she's remarkable. The show continues to be excellent. The fried chicken, I'm not coming around on Sarah as a person, but man, her fried chicken with the little corn and blackberry salad salsa sort of deal, like, I want to fly to Kentucky for that.
Yeah, I just, you know, back to the Sarah's as a potential favorite thing. Look, I know that she has done very well the last few weeks. And, I don't know. Like, I feel like she is a Kentucky cook. You know, obviously, like, Kentucky comes up for her, and it's a big thing, and she turns into a stress ball. And, you know, she feels she represents Kentucky. But I also feel like that's the kind of food that she mostly makes. You know what I mean? And it's worked out pretty well because... you know, we're in Kentucky, and there have been a lot of Kentucky-based challenges. But I don't you feel like Kelsey has been a better cook this season than Sarah has for the most part? Even if the results don't necessarily show it?
Yeah, I mean, I felt that way over the long term, but I'm just saying, like, the trajectory on Sarah is really building. I think you're right that Eric is – he just seems like he's the best, right?
Yeah, he seems like, to me, the best. And then I think you got to watch out if Michelle comes back from Last Chance Kitchen.
Yeah.
I think,
yeah, and we have not yet watched Last Chance Kitchen, but it's either Eddie or Michelle.
Yeah. You know, I think she's a force, and she has that sort of fine dining background that I think a lot of the remaining contestants don't have. Although Eric definitely does.
You know, here's another thing I was thinking about. You tell me what you think. They gave Adrian crap over using sriracha. Did you notice that?
Yes.
And
do you think that was sort of left over from Wafflegate?
Well, okay, no. That's not what I was going to say. I do wonder about that. First of all, I think she used it because it's like if you go get Filipino food, it's on the tape. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think they kind of scared her with the this is actually not Filipino food. Filipino food's closer to Spanish. This is Asian. I think they scared her away from what she was doing, and I think she was like, well, what's Filipino? Oh, I know sriracha's Filipino.
Yeah. I think the Filipino thing psyched her out quite a
bit. But that's not the point I was going to make, or the question I was going to ask. She says she put it in there, and then Tom is like, I just think it really hurts the, like, the flavor didn't build how it would have otherwise, or whatever. And, you know, last week, Sarah used the waffle mix. I'm not defending this, but Sarah used the waffle mix, and he found out about it, and afterwards was like, just the waffle didn't have the depth. Do you think Tom Colicchio could have picked out the waffle mix waffle and the sriracha short ribs if he didn't know ahead of time? Or do you think there's some confirmation bias going on there?
Well, look, I think he's definitely getting fed the information by the producers.
Well, but I mean, they outright tell him in both cases.
Yeah. So I think that, yes, but I think he knew before they outright told him. And so I think, you know what I mean? Like, it's hard to separate them. I think that they're always going to color his comments because he has the information. Right. I suspect, if you're asking me to just sort of guess, yeah, I don't know that he would say that if he was just eating it from scratch. But, you know, Tom Colicchio has a much greater and better refined palate than I do. Yeah. So,
no, it's true.
Who am I to
say? I just wonder if a guy like that can really taste that. Because, like, I know I can't, right? I know if she made a bomb-ass short rib dish that happened to have used some sriracha in it, I'd be like, that tastes like delicious short ribs. I don't know what's in it.
Can you identify when something is slightly over-seasoned? Because I feel like that's a thing that they say all the time on this show. Or slightly overcooked or undercooked. You know what I mean?
I doubt it. Like, certainly not the latter.
I can identify when something is undercooked or overcooked, but like the
significantly, sure.
The degrees when they're like it could have just needed a little bit more. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
There's a level of expertise there that I don't possess. You know what I mean?
But I think of that as like we don't know the target.
Right. Right.
Like that's different to me from like I can tell this has sriracha from a bottle.
I just think are able to identify things subtly in ways that we can't. But I also think, like, we had this in the quickfire, right? Like, when you put a blindfold on those people and just ask them to taste spices.
Exactly.
Like, it's kind of hard.
That
was
fascinating. Fascinating. And, you know, what's interesting is some of them really are good. So, obviously, some people really do have a more refined palate. And I think that being blindfolded is disorienting. But it does show you, like, not everyone who's good at cooking knows exactly what everything tastes like at every time.
Yeah. I just also want to add that as someone who has eaten Justin's fried chicken, I feel bad for him.
Because it's good.
Because it's good. And he got some lousy ingredients coming into that challenge. So
ingredients. And they actually said, ingredients-wise, he did great.
Yeah. Yeah, he just sort of overcompensated, I think.
Well, no, his was one of the ones that went in the fryer and it was too hot, so it burnt the outside and it was raw inside.
Yeah. I mean, I guess you're right. I guess that wasn't really necessarily down to he had to do like a Japanese version.
Yeah, no, he really overcame the challenge and then the fryer screwed him.
Yeah. I guess sort of in my head, I just blame that on the weird spices. But you're right; I don't think it did have anything to do with it.
It's a case of causation versus correlation.
Indeed. All right. So the next episode, right, is the last one in Kentucky, and then we're on to the finale. Yeah.
I think that's how it works. Yeah.
I'm gonna be excited for that.
I'm excited, man. It's a good group here. Even though I'm rooting against Sarah, everything that's coming out now is pretty impressive.
Yeah. We're getting down to it. You know, we definitely separated the wheat from the chaff. You can sort of tell just that, you know, there's no longer eliminations in the quick flyers.
Eddie got eliminated and they were like, "You made a beautiful chicken dish that's succulent and has a wonderful sauce."
Now get out.
Now pack your knives and go.
Right.
And the best part is then he's shaking their hands and Tom goes, "Dig deeper." It's like, what the hell does that mean? He loved it.
It was like, you know, he's like doing the Bradley Cooper. It's like, you know.
Exactly. you didn't identify enough with Muhammad Ali.
I'm gonna tell you right now, you better cook from your fucking soul. For the truth's all you get.
Well, dude, you know, you could be in a room with 100 people, and 99 of those people don't believe in you. That one person, that's Bradley Cooper.
That's right. Right there.
It's a pretty good, what's his name that you're doing?
Little Jackson Maine.
Yeah, Jackson Maine. That's pretty good.
Thanks.
Like if we or our listeners were blindfolded a la the spice test on Top Chef, I don't believe we would be able to tell the difference between you and Jackson.
Can I touch your nose?
Hopefully, I imagine if we did smell you, we would be able to tell the difference.
Yeah, hopefully, or I have some problems. Exactly. That's right. I use more steroids than Jackson Maine too. Also,
good.
Let's jump to the NBA real quick since we're talking about getting sort of down to the interesting part of the season. We're now post All-Star. I guess we're technically mid All-Star break.
Technically, yeah, I guess we are. That's weird. It's so long.
We're about to head into the post All-Star break stretch, which is, you know, kind of the kick for home as the playoffs go.
Yeah, it really has become the home stretch, which is interesting. The All-Star break has moved so late. It's like the last quarter almost.
Yeah.
Certainly third at the most.
And I kind of like that. It's like you look up and it's like, All right, now we're going to figure out who's going to the playoffs. But I just feel like there's a lot of hand-wringing out there about the league right now. And I can't tell if this is one of those things that's a generational thing where older people who are sort of anti-player movement are just sort of like, well, why are these guys unhappy and complaining all the time? Or if this is really sort of the start of a long-term problem for the NBA with guys not wanting to honor their contracts. And where do you sit on all this?
I just think in almost every walk of life, the concept of honoring contracts is viewed so arbitrarily and judged fair or unfair so subjectively. I am not sure I totally understand it. You know, I understand that, like, there's contract law and whatnot.
Right.
Generally, you want to keep contracts. But, like, contracts are broken all the time, everywhere, especially employment contracts.
Especially by the employers.
Exactly. Yeah. And I thought it was so funny listening to Bill Simmons, of all people, sort of express fear about what's happening here, right? And he cited the perfect example of why he's wrong, which is Kevin Garnett. And he's like, well, you know, Kevin Garnett, by the time – well, everyone used to say he wasn't a winner and he was afraid of the big moment. And then he missed the playoffs 3 straight years in Minnesota. And so when he finally agreed to be traded, we looked at it differently. And I'm sitting there like, so Anthony Davis is supposed to miss the playoffs a couple more times and
or be the eighth seed and get blown out in the first round.
Right. And sit out and not play in the most meaningful games during the prime of his career as one of the greatest talents of all time. Why? Why? Because the whole thing here is you don't end up in these situations as a team if you do a good job. None of these alleged malcontents is in a situation where the team built well around them.
I'm gonna throw. I don't know if I would say none. Right?
Very few.
I mean, if Jimmy Butler leaves Philadelphia, you can't say it's because they didn't put a good team around him, right?
But he's not demanding a trade out of Philadelphia. He demanded a trade to get there.
Yet.
If Jimmy Butler is demanding a trade out of Philly, that's a different conversation.
I mean, Kevin Durant, rather, obviously, is allegedly talking about leaving, and that's another situation
Incorrect. Kevin Durant is notably refusing to talk about leaving.
Thinking about leaving is what I should say.
Yes, pondering he's a free agent.
Yeah.
No one's proposing a scenario where free agents aren't allowed to leave.
Right.
What is that? So
you're just talking about the guys that have demanded a trade.
Well, I'm talking about what is the problem here. If you're telling me there's a problem, explain to me what the problem is. You can't tell me the problem is guys not honoring their contracts, guys demanding to get out of scenarios that they're in, and then cite Kevin Durant as an example.
Yeah, I think the problem. I mean, at least I don't know. It's not really a problem to me. And the reason that I think it's maybe generational is because I think that, people younger than us are just rooting for the players anyway, right? Kids now are LeBron fans, and if he's on the Lakers, fine. If he's on the Cavaliers, fine. If he's on the Heat, fine. They're going to root for LeBron.
What's wrong with that? Doesn't that make more sense? Players often stand for something.
Yeah.
Whether it's something stupid or a real cause or just who they are as a person. What is a team?
I don't necessarily see anything wrong with that, and I certainly understand as a guy who roots for Steph Curry's team, how much less fun that would be if Steph Curry is no longer on said team. You know what I mean?
Of course.
So, of course,
and I'm not criticizing people who I'm a team guy. That's my generation, but if I got to be realistic, and if my team does not create an environment that a guy wants to be a part of, I have to recognize that A, it's more than likely and more often cases than not the team's fault, not the guy's fault.
I guess. I think to assume that the player is always a perfectly rational actor in this is maybe a
I didn't mistake. Say perfectly rational actor. I said more often than not in these scenarios, the burden is mostly on the team. Even in these LeBron scenarios. Yeah, he takes more responsibility for a roster around him than most NBA players because he has more impact and he has more ability to maneuver things behind the scenes than most.
Right. And he had more leverage because he was constantly signing these one-year deals.
At the end of the day, he signed a four-year deal with the Lakers, and then Rob Pelinka and Magic Johnson went out and signed guys like Caldwell Pope and Michael Beasley and JaVale McGee.
Right, but
that's on them.
Is it on them? Because I don't see them doing that without consulting LeBron.
Fine, so they consulted LeBron. If that's his advice, don't take it. He signed on the dotted line.
I mean, I don't know. But so, how many GMs have been competent GMs have been ruined by? Working with LeBron. Look, I love LeBron. Yeah, but
I'm not saying it's easy. I'm saying the right decision is to make good moves. And you know when LeBron won't have a problem? If you're winning.
Well, I mean, he left Miami and they were winning, weren't they?
He left Miami after they lost.
In the finals? He left Cleveland after they lost in the finals, too. You can't say, look, I mean, he left as a free agent is right. I'm not angry at LeBron. I've never been angry at LeBron for leaving as a free agent. But I'm just saying, you can't say, he didn't have a good winning team around him. You know what I mean? Certainly in Miami. You could quibble with Cleveland.
You don't think he saw the writing on the wall in Miami? You don't think he thought he had a better team in Cleveland with Kyrie and Kevin Love?
Kevin Love wasn't there when he left, remember.
No, but they were two number one overall draft picks.
Yeah, one of them was. Anyway, in fact, both of them turned out to be terrible.
Decision.
If that was a look, whatever, he made a basketball decision. I'm not angry at any of these guys for making basketball decisions. I'm not angry at any of these guys like for exercising leverage.
And again, none of that stuff, that's
what all employment situations are about. Employer, employee, or ever, it's who has the most leverage, and you get what you can while you can.
And I'm okay with that. None of the LeBron stuff is relevant to the criticism about players not honoring contracts or players signing deals and then making unreasonable trade demands. I don't see any of the trade demands we're talking about right now as unreasonable. I don't.
Yeah. I mean, I don't see the demands as unreasonable. I also don't see what New Orleans did in response as unreasonable either, if that makes sense. You know what I mean?
You mean not taking the deal?
Yeah.
No, it's absolutely the prudent move.
Yeah.
And it would be the most prudent move to then send Anthony Davis home. Unfortunately, Rich Paul and Anthony Davis have done all this posturing that now they are someone's going to end up with a ton of egg on their face here. Either he's going to sit out with a bogus injury or he's going to be forced to play for a team that doesn't want him and doesn't want him around and doesn't want him to get hurt.
I don't really understand why the team wants him to play.
What's that?
I don't really understand why the team wants him to play. Like, both parties should not want him to play. Right?
The team doesn't want him to play, but because of the posturing and because of Rich Paul's, constant tampering, the NBA felt they had to make a statement and say, if he's healthy, you can't sit him.
Yeah.
Really what happened here is, and I think this is the problem the mistake players make most often, is if Rich Paul and Anthony Davis had done this aggressively behind the scenes instead of aggressively in front of the scenes, Anthony Davis might be on a different team now.
Is there such a thing as aggressively behind the scenes, though?
Yes.
Now, doesn't everything come out?
Everything might come out, but you can absolutely get stuff done in the NBA behind the scenes before you make a fuss. Rich Paul went to media outlets and specifically announced a trade demand.
Yeah, well, look, I'm not saying that Rich Paul attempted to do this aggressively behind the scenes, but I'm saying it comes out in the wash either way, ultimately, I feel like.
Yes, ultimately we would have found out that Anthony Davis orchestrated his own departure.
I mean, Kevin Durant has done virtually nothing publicly in terms of potentially going to the Knicks, but we're still here talking about it, you know what I mean? So,
well, we aren't, because I don't know that it's any more worth talking about than it was 4 months ago, but look, things at least have happened publicly there that Kevin Durant had no control over. And again, he's still not talking about it.
Right.
But
there are things that have happened that have clearly affected the team in that regard, right?
The Warriors team?
Yeah. Like, on-court fights about it. You know what I mean? Like, so.
But that was before the Knicks. That was before it was about the Knicks in particular.
It was still about him leaving.
It was about the – yes, but again – you can't force guys to sign lengths of contracts they don't want to sign. So I'm not sure what your proposed – I'm not sure what the issue with that is other than that the Warriors have to manage it.
Yeah. I don't think any of this needs a solution, to be honest. I think letting players go where they want to go within the rules that you set up is fine. You know, if you want to say that there is a tampering issue in this league, I think that's fair. I think it's maybe fair to go figure out what we want to do about tampering. But, like, guys are going to ask for trades, and I don't know that that's really wrong.
Right. Tampering is just negotiation. I don't really see the problem with it.
Well, contractually, you are supposed to have a window of exclusivity in negotiation, and tampering is other people messing with that. So I do.
Yeah,
that's the problem I see.
What do people think that exclusivity window really gets you if someone doesn't want to be there?
Yeah. I don't know.
Do you think there's a solution for tampering that would make it impossible for other teams to express that they would be interested if you get past that exclusive negotiating window?
I don't think there's any solution for tampering that makes it impossible. Right. So then it becomes, well, what is the penalty for it, right? And how much do you enforce it? That's where the issue is going to be ultimately. You can't prevent players from talking to other players. You know what I mean?
And I think it's always going to seem like selective enforcement when we know it goes on all the time and they only catch it every so often. So right. I just don't think
has the NBA season ever gone by where the Lakers weren't tampering with people?
No, and it doesn't always work. So that's the thing. I don't know that it's really a problem. And that's what I would say to the sort of Simmons argument that I heard, which was this is a slippery slope. How long until guys sign a 5-year deal and in year two are saying, get me out of here?
Yeah. I think the Simmons thing is 99. I mean, he kind of gave the game away at the end. He said the quiet part out loud. I think it's 99% that he is in basketball love with Jason Tatum, and he can't.
Exactly.
He just doesn't want him to be there for 3 years and then out. So.
And here's the thing is I'm just not sure there's any principal sign of this, what's happening now, actually being a gateway drug to that sort of chicanery.
Yeah. I'm just not sure that Jason Tatum's that good. But that's another story for another day.
I'm just saying, look at Anthony Davis. He's how many years in New Orleans of them bungling things around him, essentially?
6 or 7 at this point.
It's not just him bamboozling the team for all they're worth and then demanding out because he doesn't like the place. It's him wanting to finally have a chance to play for titles.
Yep.
That's what it is. So make your team a place you can compete for titles. And you know, it's the same thing when I hear the market size whining. It's like, but the Spurs have been better than the Knicks for virtually the entire existence of both of those franchises. So what are we talking about here?
Yeah.
You can succeed. You just have to do a good job.
Yeah. Well, or in the Spurs case, an exceptional job, I think it's fair to say. But you know.
To be that good, sure. Yeah. But they're one of the greatest franchises in modern sports. To be a team that competes for titles occasionally, you just have to do a good job.
Yeah.
If you luck into Anthony Davis.
Or a great – you're right. You can just luck into a great draft pick and then do well around it, and you're fine.
And New Orleans had every opportunity to do that and failed.
Yeah. All right. Let's jump into homework because I got to get going. And I think we have some stuff to talk about.
Yeah, we got a list. Let's get to it.
All right. Let me pull up the list. So
ready to get to homework, and yet here you are unprepared. All right,
so obviously we got Fighting With My Family, which we didn't get to last week. True Detective is wrapping up. I think you got a little preview of that on this show. We'll talk about that. I have somehow dragged you into watching one more episode of Documentary Now.
I regret agreeing to this, but fine.
That's premiering this week, and I'm told that they're doing Wild Wild Country in episode one, which I personally am dying to see. And
I
hoping
just don't
we'll
know
be
why.
Enough to
I
get
just
you
like
to
I
tolerate
can see
it.
Every joke, and it's not funny, but okay.
Okay. Desus and Marrow, which is a show that was on Viceland forever, has moved to Showtime, and that is premiering this week, and so I'm curious to see what's up with that. And
the Bodega Boys hit the big time.
Yeah. Yeah. I think this is going to be like a little boost of visibility for them.
I agree. And I also think it's kind of a trial balloon for, I don't know, millennial late night. Is that?
Yeah. And there's some interesting things happening in millennial late night between this and Hasan Minhaj and Busy Phillips, and like people are out there trying stuff, which I kind of like.
And this is a pretty big swing, so I'm interested.
And then there's an HBO movie called OG with Jeffrey Wright that we're gonna check out as well.
Love Jeffrey Wright, very interested in this. I especially like as wise old criminal, I'm into it.
Yeah, Jeffrey Wright playing a human being, I'm here for.
True.
And all right, with that, I think we can get the hell out of here.
Okay, bye.
This game's in the Admiral refrigerator. The door is closed. The light's out. Butter's getting hard. The eggs are cooling, and the Jell-O is jiggling.
So long, everybody.
And do me a favor. Have yourself a tremendous evening.